Thanks very much, Unya. I'm going to introduce Thomas Glave now. Thomas Glave is Professor of English and Latin American and Caribbean Area Studies at the State University of New York, Binghamton. Among the honors he's been awarded are the O. Henry Prize for Fiction in 1997 and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Fine Arts Center in Provincetown, as well as the Martin Luther King Jr. Visiting Professor in the Program in Writing and Humanistic Studies at MIT position in 2008-09. But my personal favorite is his contribution to the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics with a workshop entitled, Who Exactly Are Those People? Thomas is also an activist. He has a long list of community service. He's a founder member of JFLAG, the Jamaica Forum for Lesbians, All Sexuals and Gays. He's lectured at the Elmira Correctional Facility, New York, volunteered with the AIDS Hospice in Kingston, Jamaica, and in HIV/AIDS Educational Outreach in New York. He is a member of the New York Foundation for the Arts, the Southern Poverty Law Center in Alabama, of Amnesty International, and he's on the board of directors for the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies at the City University of New York. And I mention all these because obviously that's very much part of what this project, Breaking Sexual Silences, is about. Thomas Glave is therefore not just a writer, but then who is just a writer? If you're just a writer, then you don't have anything to say, do you? He's the author of the collection Whose Song and Other Stories, which was published in 2000, the non-fiction essay collection Words to Our Now, Imagination and Dissent, published in 2005, which won a Lambda Literary Award, and the edited anthology Our Caribbean, A Gathering of Contemporary Lesbian and Gay Writing from the Antilles, published in 2008, which also won the Lambda Award in 2009. And most recently, The Torturer's Wife, a collection of short stories published in 2008. Now, I want to just say a word about the Lambda Awards, since he's won two of them, and you might be wondering what they are. The Lambda Awards were founded in 1989, and every year since then, they've been awarded to the finest lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans literature available in the United States. The LAMMY is the most prestigious, competitive, and comprehensive literary award offered specifically to LGBT authors. When he received it for Our Caribbean, Thomas Glave said, and I'm now quoting Thomas, "I felt and I still feel that that award wasn't just for me, but for Caribbean LGBT writing in general. And that book was a difficult book to complete, both in terms of logistics and also conceptualization. It was an exhausting project, literally, that required an enormous amount of energy and concentration, stamina, in fact, and took 5.5 years to complete. It wasn't really welcomed or thought much of by anyone I approached in the publishing world except the publisher that finally published it. The Lambda recognition for that book, especially, felt like a kind of triumph and a gesture of respect for the work of all those amazing writers in that collection." And it's that collection that Thomas is now going to present to us. Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you very much, Jane. I want to first of all say good night to everyone. Good night. Good night. Good night. And also, I want to thank Professor Allison Donnell, Professor Evelyn O'Callaghan. I want to thank Professor Jane Bryce. And I want to say, I mean, the generosity and hospitality that have been extended to us have just been remarkable. And I want to say what a joy and an absolute pleasure it is to hear Unya read. Once again, the last time I heard Unya read was actually in Jamaica at the Calabash Festival. And after hearing these selections of Buxton Spice again tonight, I didn't tell you this when you sat down, but I'm going to go back and read the book again. I've read it three times, I've taught it twice, and I'm going to go and dig it out from where it's not very far in my drawer, under two other books that tied running, actually, and read it again in a couple of weeks when I get back to my own place. But this is also a place. It's a joy to be back at Cave Hill, and I just want to say thank you again. It's a pleasure. I am going to read, as Jane said, from Our Caribbean, and then I'll do a brief reading from The Torturer's Wife, from a story that is set in Jamaica. But just to say a little bit about Our Caribbean, aside from what you already heard, The book contains the work of 37 writers from 14 Caribbean countries, covering about 4 to 5 language groups, including some Creole groups. And so everything in the book appears in English translation, which I said was in some ways a disservice to the writers who don't write, think, dream, or speak in English, because their work appeared behind a kind of scrim of translation. And Betty Wilson, who's in the audience tonight, actually from Jamaica, and I have talked about translation before, and many of her comments about translation really, really hit home very hard when I was thinking about the sorts of logistics involved in dealing with this in this book. I'm going to read 2 selections from the collection, one by a Bahamian writer, Helen Clonaris, and then one by a Jamaican, Makeda Silvera. So the first by Helen Clonaris is called Independence Day Letter. And this piece was, it's brief, it was published in 2004 in Nassau Daily Tribune as an open letter to the Bahamian population. And so you'll hear what she has to say here just now. She says, Dear beloved community, it is the night of Independence Day. This country has turned 31 years old. I am only 4 years older. This is my home. This country where my grandparents came looking for new life, opportunities, a new way, hope. But I don't feel up to celebrating. Tomorrow, I have been told, at 5 o'clock p.m., there will be a protest in Rawson Square to show us gays and lesbians, bisexuals and tranny folk how much we are not wanted in our own country, to show us just how much we are not cared for, not valued by our brothers and sisters who believe they know what is good and righteous and godly. I live in a country that doesn't think I should exist. I live in a country where not one church leader has come to our defense publicly, where not one church leader has risen to the call of spirit to say loudly that this is a time for understanding, not hate. Instead, the church has, almost of one accord, it would seem, turned its collective back on the gay and lesbian community, condemning us all as sinners, or worse still, knowing that we are not sinners, keeping quiet anyhow because it is too afraid to show authentic compassion. Such compassion might be dangerous. It might expose a sympathy not permitted. Such compassion might create affiliations that could put jobs and reputations on the proverbial line. It is a Saturday night, Independence weekend, and there is not one church on this island that would welcome me and my kind publicly, speak our names openly, with respect, and honor us for who we are. I don't want to be accommodated. I want to be embraced. I need witnesses who are not afraid of what I am. If I'm going to be born again, I want to get born with greater love for and pride in who I already am. I need a minister who sees the sacred in me and won't turn his back on that sacredness because he doesn't know how to explain this kind of sacredness to his neighbors. I need a church, and there is not one. I'm angry at the church, angry at the Catholics, angry at the Anglicans, angry at the Baptists. I'm especially angry at the gay priests in this country who won't stand on the ground of their own truth and create a ministry for their own community, for the walking wounded who are told over and over that we are not right, that we are not good, that we are not welcome. But this is our home, too. I'm angry at these priests because they enjoy the privileges of priesthood, a priesthood built on secrets, half-truths, and lies, in which they remain too invested in that privilege to confront the churches and their own hypocrisies and injustices. I'm angry at suppressed truths at pedophiles. I'm angry at pedophiles fired from church-run schools but never brought to justice. I'm angry at violations suppressed. I am angry because I live in exile in this, my own country. I am angry because I hear the same tired and misconceived arguments over and over, and they're wearing me out, down. Missiles in the spirit are setting down in my front room every day, and every day I do the work of cleaning up the mess, the debris, shaken and outraged and grieved. Every day I pray for protection from the church. The church itself perpetrating a war on lesbians and gay men in this country, my home. Every day I hear apostles and pastors and bishops ranting and raving about how we are unnatural and deviant and dangerous. There is no love in their voices, no compassion in their words. Love the sinner, hate the sin. I talked with a pastor just the other day. He introduced himself to me after a press conference, and I spoke with him, wanting to be real. I told him that I respected his right to believe what he does. I told him that I would be one of the first to defend his right to speak freely and to act as his conscience bids him to. I told him that I hoped one day for us to stop this fighting across this imaginary line that divides us and begin telling the true, true stories that make us the people we are, acting and speaking out here in the world, because it's these stories that tell the truth about us and can speak to the heart of each of us. I told him that gay people aren't all about doing whatever pleases us and caring less about anyone else. That is a misrepresentation. I told him that gay people's lives are often full of pain. He looked at me with what seemed like sincerity and said simply, "I know." Throughout this exchange, the pastor seemed to be listening. He seemed to want to hear what I had to say, human being to human being. It felt good to be that real with this man whom I thought was my enemy. Perhaps I had misjudged him. We bade each other farewell, and then as I turned to go, I heard a laugh. It was a laugh that belonged to a woman, from a reverend, a friend of this pastor, who came to stand beside him. She laughed smugly, and I thought I heard the words, "Well, if they're in so much pain, they should come back to God." And then I heard the pastor's laugh, too. Now, if I were a more bigoty woman, I would have turned back and asked the reverend, the female reverend, why she was laughing. I would have asked the pastor, the male pastor, if he thought what I had revealed to him in earnest and in sincerity was funny. I would have told them how self-righteous and arrogant and wrong they were to presume that I had ever left God, or that God had ever left me to stand with them alone. But alas, I did not. I can only say that I left feeling that all too familiar outrage that comes with just being alive. In the distance, I hear the staccato of fireworks, independent celebrations underway, but I do not feel part of them. Tomorrow afternoon, in the middle of downtown Nassau, Bahamians, my sisters and brothers, will gather to make certain I am aware of how I am not welcome here, of how much I am not cared for, nor valued as I am, of how much better it would be if I did not exist. It is that personal, that real. The truth is, gay men and lesbians do exist. We're not deviant. We are not a sacred part. We are a sacred part of the natural diversity of this planet. We are part of the multicolored, multi-textured, multifaceted image of Goddess. We are your daughters, your sons, your brothers, your sisters, your grandchildren, your cousins, your mothers, your fathers, your aunts, and your uncles. We are your great-grandmothers. We are the children not born yet. We have important roles to play in the shaping of our society, the one we share with you. We are your family. Cut any one of us away from you and we both will bleed. We both will hurt. This is not the letter I had hoped to write in honor of this day. I had hoped to tell you how hopeful I am, how much I love us, this culture, this society of ours, which is strongly rooted, though we still are struggling to find our way forward through struggles together. I had hoped to tell you that I love how passionate we are about our everyday culture. Saturday morning souse and the beat of a goatskin drum that has the power to make you and your spirit get up, stand up, and go find out what it is you've been missing. I love the everyday spirituality that calls acquaintances cousin, neighbors beloved, and children baby doll and sweetness. I love that there is still a spiritual wisdom that endures outside the walls of prestigious churches, on the streets, the kind of wisdom that doesn't just believe but knows without need of political slogans that we all are family, regardless of skin color. Someone asked me some weeks ago, "What is it that you all really want?" I want to answer that for you now, sir, and anyone else who may be listening. I want to answer that now, again and again. What I want on this night of independence is this: a Bahamas that is committed to becoming honest enough and brave enough, and, in the words of Chicana lesbian writer Cherie Moraga, quote, "strong enough to embrace a full range of racial diversities, human sexualities, and expressions of gender," end quote. as well as a diversity of spiritual traditions and philosophical and ideological opinions. I want a Bahamas that is committed to restructuring its internal foundations so that it can better respond to issues of difference, not with the fear and anger that are now plaguing us, but with openness and genuine desire for understanding and communication and relationship. I still want a Bahamas in which women's lives are as important as the lives of men, and where children are seen and heard and listened to for their advice as to how we can be better parents and teachers and friends to them. I still want a Bahamas committed to decolonization, the taking down and the taking apart of old colonial ways of seeing, working, teaching, learning, being. I want a Bahamas wise enough and courageous enough to support progressive vision and to empower those with the emotional, spiritual, and intellectual creativity to put that vision into action. Sheree Moraga quoted once again, "Without the dream of a free world," wrote Moraga, "a free world would never be realized," end quote. I want a Bahamas where we aren't afraid to keep on dreaming, no matter how heretical our dreams may at first appear. Keeping the Faith, Helen Klonaris, Nassau, July 10th, 2004. Thank you, and thanks to Helen. I'm going to just read this brief selection from this essay by Makeda Silvera from Jamaica, published originally in 1992. It has since become a classic. "Man Royals and Sodomites, Some Thoughts on the Invisibility of Afro-Caribbean Lesbians." Actually, interestingly, this essay is now taught quite a bit in women's studies and feminist studies in the Caribbean, Latin America, and other places. I'm not starting from the beginning, so just to go on a little bit from here. She says, "The veranda. My grandmother sat on the veranda in the evenings after all the chores were done to read the newspaper. People, mostly women, gathered there to discuss life. Life covered every conceivable topic: economic, local, political, social, and sexual. The high price of saltfish, the scarcity of flour, the nice piece of yellow yam bought at Coronation Market, Mr. Lamb, the shopkeeper who was taking liberty with Miss Inez, the fights women had with their menfolk, work, suspicions of Miss Iris and Miss Punsey carrying on something between them, the cost of school books. My grandmother usually had lots of advice to pass on to the women on the veranda, all grounded in the Bible. Granny believed in Jesus, in good and evil, and in repentance. She was also a practical and sociable woman. Her faith didn't interfere with her perception of what it meant to be a poor black woman. Neither did it interfere with our Friday night visits to my Aunt Marie's bar. I remember sitting outside on the piazza with my grandmother, two grand aunts, and three or four of their women friends. I liked their flashy smiles, and I was fascinated by their independence, ease, and their laughter. I loved their names: Cherry Rose, Blossom, Jonesy, Poinsettia, Ivory, Pearl, Iris, Bloom, Dahlia, Babes. Whenever the conversation came around to some big woman talk, who was sleeping with whom or whose daughter just got fallen, I was sent off to get a glass of water for an adult or a bottle of cola champagne. Every Friday night, I drank as much as half a dozen bottles of cola champagne, but I still managed to hear snippets of words, tail ends of conversations about women together. In Jamaica, the words used to describe many of these women would be man royal and or sodomite. I heard sodomite whispered a lot during my primary school years, and tales of women secretly having sex, joining at the genitals, and being taken to the hospital to be cut apart were told in the schoolyard. Invariably, one of the women would die. Every 5 to 10 years, the same story would surface. At times, it would even be published in the newspaper. Such stories always generated much talking and speculation, from things like, "Boy, them can't get nasty, sir," to some wise old woman saying, "But this can't happen. After all, two shatan can't join," meaning identical objects cannot go into the other. The act of loving someone of the same sex was sinful, abnormal, something to hide. Even today, it isn't unusual or uncommon to be asked, so how did two women do it? What one use for a penis? Who is the man and who is the woman? It's inconceivable that women can have intimate relationships that are whole, that are not lacking because of the absence of a man. It's assumed that women in such relationships must be imitating men. The word sodomite, of course, derives from the Old Testament. Its common use to describe lesbians or any strong, independent woman is peculiar to Jamaica, a culture historically and strongly grounded in the Bible. Although Christian values have dominated the world, their effect in slave colonies is particular. Our foreparents gained access to literacy through the Bible when they were indoctrinated by missionaries. It provided powerful and ancient stories of strength, endurance, and hope, which reflected their own fight against oppression. This book has been so powerful that it continues to bind our lives with its racism and misogyny. Thus, the importance the Bible plays in Afro-Caribbean culture must be recognized in order to understand the historical and political context for the invisibility of lesbians. The wrath of God, quote, rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah, end quote, Genesis 19:24. How could a Caribbean woman claim the name sodomite? And when, Bible in hand, my grandmother responded to my love by sitting me down at the age of 27 to quote Genesis, it was within the context of this tradition, this politic. When she pointed out that this was a white people thing, or a thing only people with mixed blood was involved in, to explain or include my love with a woman of mixed blood, it was a strong denial of many ordinary black working class women she knew. It was finally through my conversations with my grandmother, my mother, and my mother's friend 5 years later that I began to realize the scope of this denial, which was intended to dissuade and protect me. She knew too well that any woman who took a woman lover was attempting to walk on fire, entering a no man's land. I began to see how commonplace the act of loving women really was, particularly in working class communities, and I realized, too, just how heavily shame and silence weighed down this act. A conversation with a friend of my mother. Quote, well, when I was growing up, we didn't hear much about woman and woman. They weren't suspect. There was much talk about Batman business when I was a teenager in the 1950s. I remember one story about a man who was suspect, and that every night when he was coming home, a group of guys used to lay wait for him and stone him so viciously that he had to run for his life. Them time, he was safe only in the day. Now, with women, nobody really suspected. I grew up in the country, and I grew up seeing women holding hands, hugging up, sleeping together in one bed, and there was no question. Some of this was based purely on emotional friendship, but I also knew of cases where the women were dealing, but no one really suspected. Close people around knew, but not everyone. It wasn't a thing that you would go out and broadcast. It would be something just between the two people. Also, one important thing is that the women who were involved carried on with life just the same. No big political statements were made. These women still went to church, still got baptized, still went on pilgrimage, and I'm thinking about one particular woman named Aunt Vi, a very strong woman, strong-willed in everything. They used to call her Man Royal behind her back, but no one ever dared meddle with her. Things are different now in Jamaica. Now all you have to do is not respond to a man's call to you and then call you sodomite or lesbian. I guess it was different back then 40 years ago because it was harder for anybody to really conceive of two women sleeping together and being sexual. But I do remember when you were suspect, people would talk about you. You were definitely classed as different, not normal, a bit of a crazy. But women never really got stoned like the men. What I remember is that if you were a single woman alone, or two single women living together, and a few people suspected this, and when I say a few people, I mean like a few guys, sometimes other crimes were committed against the women, some very violent, some very subtle. Battery was common, especially in Kingston. A group of men would suspect a woman or have it out for her because she was a sodomite or because she acted man royal, and so the men would organize and gang rape whichever woman was suspect. Sometimes it was reported in the newspapers, other times it was not. But when you live in a little community, you don't need a newspaper to tell what's going on. You know by word of mouth, and those stories were frequent. Sometimes you also knew the men who did the battery. Other subtle forms of this was scorning the women, meaning that you didn't eat anything from them, especially a cooked meal. It was almost as if those accused of being man-royal or sodomite could contaminate. And just briefly from a conversation with her grandmother, and I'll close this section. Am I okay for time? A little bit? Yeah? Okay. A conversation with my grandmother. I'm only telling you this so that you can understand that this is not a profession to be proud of and to get involved in. Everybody should be curious, and I know you were born with that ever since you're growing up as a child, and I can't fight against that because that is how everybody gets to know what's in the world. I'm only telling you this because when you were a teenager, you always say you want to experience everything and make up your mind on your own. You didn't like people telling you what was wrong and right. That always used to scare me. Experience is good, yes, but it has to be balanced. You have to know when you have too much experience in one area. I'm telling you this because I think you have enough experience in this to decide now to go back to the normal way. You have two children. Do you want them to grow up knowing this is the life you take? But this is for you to decide. I'm going to close very quickly with a selection from a story called Out There, which takes place in Jamaica, which is in my book of fiction, The Torturer's Wife. And this takes place entirely in Jamaica. And the moment at which I'm going to look is just focusing on two principal characters, two men, one named Aston, a middle-class brown man, middle to upper-middle-class brown man who's married and has children and lives in Upper St. Andrew in Kingston, if you know that milieu. And poor or working-class fisherman, darker-skinned, whom he fetishizes and also desires, named Solomon James, whose pet name is Bratty, right? So I'm just going to read a little bit of this section and show some of Aston's desire for Bratty. Solomon, who soon after their first meeting had, in spite of the potential obstacles of his own high brownness, Aston's, versus Solomon's deep blackness, insisted that Aston call him so intimately Bratty. What the fisherman had made clear was how he preferred to be addressed. Not long after the two men had first encountered one another on the winding South Coast Road out in the dry parish, St. Thomas. That had been a blazing Saturday early afternoon when the staunch Adventists were at worship and those in the area who fished and knew and competed with each other stood in that particular place by the side of the road with their day's catch in the hope of selling everything before the sun's vindictiveness ravaged their bounty. Driving by slowly as he had been, half dreaming about something peculiar Carol, his wife, had mentioned to him that morning, Aston had seen the fishermen standing by the side of the road and then that one. That one, who after only a few minutes of conversation had told the high brown city man, as if he were a true brethren, that Bratty, not Solomon, was his preferred name. One of those at first, on the face of it, unlikely but still charming Jamaican pet names originated sometime in childhood. Yes, sir, is my uncle did name me so. A true, Solomon had told Aston early on in his deep eastern Jamaica patois during one of their subsequent brief meetings by the side of the road. The city man always happening to drive past in his pajero, and the countryman standing exactly there or in a tree-shaded spot nearby, holding up for driver's inspection a ring of snapper or sometimes a few brilliant azure-finned parrot, sometimes chatting quietly with his cronies. Solomon, to Aston's eyes and all those passings by, always so utterly beautiful, probably in his mid-40s, you could never precisely tell the ages of the very poor, as you could more accurately with others. A face full of wrinkles and a mouth of missing teeth, none of which astonishingly marred Bratty's sculpted beauty, could belong to a person still only in his mid-30s. The fisherman not at all self-conscious before the upper-middle-class city man, Bratty, with a fisherman's rough hands made tough by harsh hours under the unforgiving sun out on the sea, from the very first completely unabashed about speaking full patois to the English-speaking city man. Aston had been struck by the fact that in speaking with him, Solomon never struggled in self-conscious English as his kind tended so often to do, ashamed as many of them had been taught to be of patois, yet stumbling through all the typical mispronunciations and embarrassing malapropisms glaringly present in their unguaranteed English. Miss Assimit for Mr. Smith, certificate for birth certificate, extinguished for distinguished. Yet, with his shrewdly attentive eyes, Solomon seemed to take in a great deal during the few brief conversations they had had, even, especially, conversing with a city brown man like him. My uncle, Solomon, had told Aston early on, that was my mother, brother. Him did all the while tell my mother say that me would go to be one spoil at picnic because she didn't have a one day cane me. Even when they run up and down the road with all the other boy them round the place, so. Him did always tell her, say, you're going to spoil that the boy there, him did say to her. So him did stay, always vex up. Him did always that kind of thinky-thinky. But trust me, me did know Sam was a good man, a good Christian. So now one Sunday morning, when me did make myself ready, I go to church. Him did start to call me Bratty. Bratty, him did say to me, say, you was one little Bratty, Bratty boy. So him did say to me upon the road, so the name kind of sticky. Eh? And from that time, all the boy them in town did follow him up and start from then to call me Bratty. It's so them call me till now. But me true name my mother gimme is Solomon, for true. Solomon Aston had listened enraptured to the tale of naming, originated in vexation and a poor countryman's exasperation, endeavoring to imagine the high-spirited, mischievous young Bratty. He imagined the uncle's unpredictable wrath in a country that in those years had been powerfully convinced of the absolute correctness of very corporal punishment. Eh-eh, he imagined the wrathful uncle scolding, but what kind of hard-headed boy it is? Mind me don't bruck your forehead, Bratty boy. The reverie caused him to smile and did not demand that he acknowledge the rippling feelings of protection toward that younger Solomon Bratty. And so, of course, he had never told anyone, no one, that yes, believe it. He had always wanted, really and truly above all else, to curl his fingers around Solomon's surely Guinness-sized black balls and squeeze his hand around the surely plantain-thick, uncircumcised black hood and rub it, after which he would raise his hand to his face in order to sniff and lick, suck what he knew would be the strong roadside sweat crotch smell, pure hood. Then pull that hood that was not brown like his own, but black as the ace of Ross Clot spades, he thought, stiffening more at the thought. How much stiffer could his own hood get before it tore a path through his zipper? Pull it, the fisherman's road sweaty, sea salty, rancid cock into his mouth. Inna it, in order to taste and suck sweat and strong hood smell, and ultimately Bratty's charging heat that would have jetted so powerfully power out of that engorged black manhood. He had imagined Solomon Bratty filling his throat and then, yes, of course, taking him from behind, Solomon's hood deep in a what he too would have liked as daringly and rebelliously as others had done to have called his pussy, shouting out in his most unspeakable, dangerous imagination words like, Bratty, come breed me. Bratty, brethren, come fuck me now. Bratty, and grind your cocky hot in my pussy. Solomon's black manhood filling up his pussy, he imagined, and roughing it in a way nothing his wife nor any woman could ever have done or would ever be able to do. He had never told anyone how many times he had imagined all that, the more violent parts, and then the kisses that Bratty brethren would have bestowed upon him. Kisses bestowed mouth to mouth as the other man, that dutty black man, threw his fisherman's arms around him and held him and... Thank you.
Before we move on to the next part of the evening, would people just like to make themselves more comfortable? I'm aware that